Hello there. Today is Thursday, December 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump has officially become only the third U.S. president to be impeached.
We did nothing wrong. We did nothing wrong. And we have tremendous support in the Republican Party.
A new documentary argues media coverage of elephant poaching isn't telling the whole story.
There's a space in between good and evil that is the reality of what's going on, and no one is embracing that reality.
So ahead, at the age of 80, an iconic folk singer has a number one hit. It's all on today's International Edition.
Article 1 is adopted. Article 2 is adopted.
Donald Trump became the third U.S. president to be impeached on Wednesday as the House of Representatives formally charged him with two articles of impeachment for abuse of power and obstruction of justice in a historic step that will inflame partisan tensions across a deeply divided America. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke to reporters after the vote.
December 18th, a great day for the Constitution of the United States, a sad one for America, that the president's reckless activities necessitated us our having to introduce articles of impeachment.
And in an emotional moment, Pelosi also remembered the chair of one prominent House committee conducting investigations and someone who was beloved.
Just want to add that one person who isn't with us physically in this room, but I know is present, was present all day for the deliberations, our chair of the Gov Reform, our Oversight Committee chair, our North Star, Elijah Cummings. He said, when the history books are written about this tumultuous era, I want them to show that I was among those in the House of Representatives who stood up to lawlessness and tyranny. He also said, somewhat presciently, when we're dancing with the angels, the question will be, what did you do to make sure we kept our democracy intact? We did all we could, Elijah. We passed the two articles of impeachment. The president is impeached.
President Trump, who's seeking another four-year term in the November 2020 presidential election, has called the impeachment drive an attempted coup by Democrats seeking to nullify his 2016 election victory. He rallied supporters in Michigan Wednesday night as the House voted to impeach him.
It's so much fun. They want to impeach you. They want to do worse than that. By the way, it doesn't really feel like we're being impeached, do you?
Well, no president in the 243-year history of the U.S. has been removed from office by impeachment. The Senate's top Republican, Mitch McConnell, has predicted there is no chance his chamber will remove Trump when it holds its trial. Joining us to discuss what is next, Robert Deitz, professor at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. He's a former senior counselor to the director of the Central Intelligence Agency and formerly general counsel at the National Security Agency. Thank you for being with us. So we know this moves to the Senate now, but is it appropriate to say that he is impeached?
Once you're impeached forever, but that's effectively like saying once you're indicted, you're forever indicted. You would need, after the indictment, of course, and again, with the analogy to a grand jury, you go to a trial. This is not like, of course, a criminal trial where you generally have a jury of 12 people. This is a trial in front of the U.S. Senate, which means you've got a jury of 100 people. The analogy is helpful, but it can also be a little bit misleading. You'll notice, for example, that some percentage of senators has said that Trump is not guilty of anything, no high crimes, misdemeanors, and so forth, and they've made up their mind. As you know, in the criminal law context, if a juror said to a judge impaneling him, "Hey, judge, don't bother. I know he's guilty, or I know he's innocent," the judge would discharge him from the jury. But in this context, being prejudiced one direction or another does not disqualify a senator from serving as a juror.
What should we expect to see as far as the actual process then, and who oversees this? Is there a judge?
There is, but you're asking a very good question, a very hard question, because I don't think it's been decided yet. The judge who sits in trial part of the hearing is the Chief Justice of the United States, in this case, Chief Justice Roberts, and issues about evidentiary rulings and that kind of thing will go, you know, in front of him. But the problem is that there really are no particular, there are no set rules. And so I suspect that a Chief Justice's decisions could actually be overruled by the Senate, because this is not a normal trial, and so you don't want to think of this as in a due process kind of context. To answer your question specifically, there are kind of two ways this can go. One is to basically have floor managers outline the evidence, and the other is actually to call witnesses. Senator McConnell has said there aren't going to be any witnesses.
Right.
And so what you'll end up with is floor managers providing the summary of what the case is coming out of the House of Representatives.
If Mitch McConnell and some others, at least we know, another staunch ally of President Trump, Senator Lindsey Graham, has said they've pretty much made up their mind,
yep,
and that they are not unbiased, should they recuse themselves? Shouldn't it be an unbiased situation?
Yeah, in principle it should be, but it's not. I doubt whether it ever is. I mean, after all, these are elected politicians. When a politician in the executive branch is on the same side as a politician in the legislative branch, they're probably going to get along. And that's the case here, that the president is a Republican, and the people in the Senate who are Republicans are favoring him, and the people in the Senate who are Democrats are disfavoring him. So the idea that you could actually have an unbiased 100 people, yeah, that's more a fantasy than a possibility.
Well, the Republicans argued in the hearings, including this very last one in the full House of Representatives, that the outcome is going to be that the president will remain the president and that he will be stronger for it, and that this will be a very big black mark on Democrats. I know that's kind of a political question. Is it a foregone conclusion?
No, I don't think it is. I have said, I believe, on this very program in the past that, well, really two things. One is, I think Donald Trump is not nearly as casual about this as he kind of puts forth the image of being. That is, I think this is deeply troublesome, because after all, he's the third American president to be impeached, and that's a stain. You can laugh it off and say, oh, you know, the process was crooked and blah, blah, blah. But the fact is, he's going down in the history books in not a very good way, no matter what. So I think that harms him. With respect to Republicans who are sitting as jurors, I think it is very difficult to listen to evidence and close your eyes and plug up your ears and pretend that you're not hearing it. Because if you do hear it, there's going to be a little voice inside you that says, you know, there's something to this. So I don't think this is quite as easy as the president and his staunchest allies make it seem as though it is.
All right, Robert Deitz, he's a professor at George Mason University, Schar School of Policy and Government. The sixth and final Democratic presidential debate of the year will be held later tonight on the campus of Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California. Only 7 of 15 candidates seeking the nomination to challenge President Trump will be on stage this time as the first primary contests early next year draw closer. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on the significance of this debate and the issues young student voters want to hear about from the candidates.
One more thing is on some students' minds at Loyola Marymount University besides final exams. It's the big nationally televised debate that will be held on campus.
Well, when I found out I was going to be on campus, my first thought was to change my flight home so I could stay.
I was excited. I thought that was a really cool thing for LMU to get to host.
California, with 495 delegates at stake, will play a bigger role in next year's Democratic primary battle, especially after moving up its primary election date by 3 months. That's one reason for the party's choice to hold the final debate in Los Angeles this year.
They will be more relevant than they normally have been, because in most cases, we know who the nominee will be by the time it got to California. And we were just ratifying what already had been decided. That got a little old for most Californians. And so now we're going to be very important, and we'll have a strong say.
Primary voters in California, a solidly Democratic state, will be going to the polls on March 3rd, Super Tuesday, when many other states will also be holding primaries or caucuses. Another reason why the candidates are debating here is because of the money.
Los Angeles is a place where candidates do not campaign so much as come for the money, to shake the money tree. The donors come from a rich variety of sources. You've got Hollywood, you've got a very strong component of the gay community.
The top four contenders continue to be Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg. But analysts say keep an eye on entrepreneur Andrew Yang, who just barely qualified for the debate. He probably won't make it to the top this time, but
he's established himself as a player. So the question is not what will Yang do now, it's what will he do in the next 2, 4, 6, 8, or 10 years. You can see him being in a Democratic president's cabinet, establishing himself as a person of weight and gravitas, and sort of channeling that to something bigger in the future.
Many of the Loyola Marymount students who are following the debates are focused on U.S. Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. The topics that interest them are as diverse as the students' backgrounds. Texan Havana Campos studies biochemistry.
The three topics in this election that concern me the most would be climate change, health care, and immigration reform.
Peter Martin is a political science student from California.
One thing that I feel I have not heard enough from the Democratic candidates is talking about both election security and election legitimacy, because over the past several decades there have been a lot of concerns about gerrymandering of congressional districts, about voter disenfranchisement through voter identification laws, things like that.
English major Gabriella Jekyll from Washington State wants candidates to talk more about the issue many college students are worried about.
We're starting to hear a lot more about student debt, issues that affect young voters, which is really important.
Young and old Democratic voters will not only hit the polls in California on Super Tuesday, but also in 13 other states, including Texas. The results could determine who will run against President Trump in the general election next November. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. The Trump administration is seeking to bar convicted immigrants from asylum in the U.S. Venezuelans continue to leave as political and economic crisis deepens, while prosecutors order the arrest of Bolivia's ex-president. And a study shows India leads the world in pollution-linked deaths. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A federal appeals court in the U.S. has ruled against the, quote, individual mandate in the Obamacare health care law. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
A federal appeals court has ruled the individual mandate part of President Barack Obama's health care law is invalid. The 2-1 ruling was handed down by a panel of the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. The panel upheld a 2018 finding by Texas-based U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor that the so-called individual mandate requiring insurance was rendered unconstitutional when Congress reduced a tax on people without insurance to zero in 2017. The 5th Circuit panel did not issue a decision on whether other parts of the Affordable Care Act can be severed from the individual mandate and survive. I'm Mike Gracia.
Well, we hear so much about the plight of elephants who are being killed at alarming rates for their ivory, and despite a growing outcry and governments banning the sales of ivory. But a new documentary, When Lambs Become Lions, gives an intimate and strikingly honest look at elephant poaching in Kenya. It's told from both the perspective of poachers and the rangers pursuing them. At the film's core is the human side of why people do what they do, given their circumstances. Joining us to talk more about it is director John Casby, who followed his subjects over a 3-year period. Thank you so much for being with us. You've done a lot of different projects in Africa and Kenya in particular. that were not related to this at all. So how did it all come about?
That were the ones that were like, look, there's a lot of people coming in and telling the story of conservation, which is great, but they're missing this huge part of it, which is the side of the hunters that no one is talking about. And what we're feeling is happening is that outsiders are coming in and taking our stories and kind of funneling these stories through this very Hollywood good versus evil narrative, which makes a lot of sense. Like, it's easier to consume, but what I was hearing from folks on the ground is that this is not accurate. There's a space in between good and evil that is the reality of what's going on, and no one is embracing that reality. And so at the beginning, they were pushing me mostly to the poacher side. They're saying really just like, come and let's just do a short film about the hunters and try to see why they do what they do and try to understand their choices. And maybe that can add to the conversation. And after 8 months of being there and kind of building a relationship with X and Lucas, the two main poachers in the film, I quickly realized that these were not separate sides at all. And that Asan, who was X's cousin and who is a wildlife ranger, feels just as connected to them as anyone else. And it starts feeling to me more like one community that didn't feel like there was an infrastructure to do things outside of protecting and hunting rather than two separate sides that were actually against each other.
When you say they aren't on different sides, you mean they care about wildlife, or what exactly did you mean by that?
What I mean by they aren't on different sides is that I don't think they associate their identity with what they do. Mm. I think at the end of the day, they're trying to feed their kids, and that's the number one priority, and that will override anything else. And until that meat is met, I don't think you can really start taking pride in your job yet. The other thing is that, like, the sides switch all the time. Like, poachers become rangers, and rangers become poachers. Like, it's pretty interchangeable, and the skills translate really well. Poachers become the best rangers because they understand the land, they understand the weather, they understand the animals, they know how poachers think. But when you're recruiting poachers to become rangers, which a lot of organizations in Kenya are doing, you've then got a group of people who are still connected to those communities, and they're still friends, and in some cases, like in the film, family.
So is the film, would you say it's sympathetic to poachers, or just gives the perspective of understanding why they do what they do, and it's not necessarily good versus evil?
I wouldn't use the word sympathetic. I would say rather than trying to necessarily justify or judge either side's behavior, this was an effort in understanding. And through the process of spending 3 years really trying to understand and really not trying to tell people what to think, not trying to guide people on how to feel, but just like presenting the experience that I had in the field through the film and then letting audiences wrestle with it on their own and bring their own perspective to it to amount to something bigger than the individual parts. That was kind of the goal, because that's also reflective of how it was. I went in my first meeting with X, I kind of had the preconceived notions that I think most people do on the situation, which is that ivory dealers and poachers are bad. They're doing something that is bad, the motivations are not justified. And I was surprised to find that X was very direct and honest about what he did. He wasn't secretive. He didn't seem to have a lot of shame around it. He was very clear. And that kind of threw me off. And once that was established, once this kind of honest communication was established, I found him to be charming. Like, he was charming me. He was making me laugh. I was enjoying my time with him. And after that first interaction, I couldn't stop thinking about him. I couldn't stop thinking about how is this guy who, you know, in one breath will say he'll never do the killing because he doesn't believe in being a part of that. On the other hand, will also order men to go and take elephants down and sell their tusks. It didn't make sense to me. I felt very challenged and conflicted about him as a character, but also at the same time wanted to be around him more.
What was his justification, and why did he feel the way he did?
I think he had a huge chip on his shoulder. I think he feels like the narrative has been told a certain way, not just in the media, but in the ways that people talk about it, which is that this is a good versus evil situation, and that, you know, rangers are good and poachers are bad. And from his perspective, you know, he was a child when his father was shot in the head 15 times by rangers. And that's kind of the story he grew up knowing about his dad. And that was swept under the rug. There were no consequences. I mean, one of the first things he told me is, yes, we're out here killing elephants, but the rangers are out there killing humans. No one talks about that. And so I think that was the first thing for me. And the second thing was, I think when you're waking up and going to sleep every day thinking about how you're going to feed your kids, it's a different way of thinking. There's a privilege in having ethics around these issues that can be achieved once your basic needs have been met. And once your basic needs are not met, I think it's really hard to think in that way.
All right, that is John Casby. We will be right back with more of our interview. He is the director of a new documentary, When Lambs Become Lions. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
On our our voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Again, we hear so much about the plight of elephants being killed at alarming rates for their ivory. It's a species whose survival has garnered enormous compassion and concern. The new documentary, When Lambs Become Lions, gives an intimate and strikingly honest look at elephant poaching in Kenya, told by both the perspective of the poachers and of the rangers pursuing them. At the film's core is the human side of why people do what they do given their circumstances. Back with us is the film's director, John Casby, who followed his subjects over a three-year period, gaining extraordinary access and trust on both sides of this ideological and ethical spectrum. How were you able to get them to trust you enough to be so intimately involved with them on a day-to-day basis?
So about the first 7 months of the project, I wasn't really shooting. I was just there spending time living with them, cooking with them, going on walks, watching films, really forming a foundation of trust and a meaningful relationship that was separate from the film. You know, it wasn't just like, I'm here getting to know you so we can make this film. It was like, I'm here getting to know you because I want to understand you better. Whether we make this film or not, like, that exists. So I think it was really like prioritizing the relationship and letting that be the forefront of everything we did, because there are definitely times where we're filming guys doing illegal activities and that's super sensitive and they're taking huge amounts of trust in me and the way I'm going to kind of use that material. And so when things would go wrong, which they always will, we needed something sturdy to fall back on, and that became the relationship.
Were they afraid of being caught because of the film, and did you do anything to try to protect their identity or protect them from actually being caught because of what they were doing for you to share their story?
It's a really good question. So at the beginning, I was really nervous about this. And this is one of the first things I brought up with X and Lucas, you know, like, how do you all feel about me? This is a collaboration and it's really important that you all are proud of what we make. But at the same time, I have a few constraints. Like, I want to be there for everything. And this isn't going to be a story of the past. We're talking about the future. Like, I want to put audiences in your shoes. I want people to feel what you're going through. And that means being on the hunt. That means watching you do your deals. And at the beginning, I was like, you know, how do you all feel about that? Like, there could be repercussions from that. And what they told me is we're not worried about that. Like, everyone here knows what we do. There are no secrets in this town. And so at the beginning, they didn't seem nervous about it. But then once the ivory burn happened, that sent a shockwave through this poaching community. And a lot of people stopped doing it and they got a little bit more nervous. And that's also around when we were starting to edit. So at that point, I started consulting with lawyers in Kenya and in the U.S., kind of showing them the film and asking, at what point are we putting these guys in a legal situation that's problematic? Because the last thing we want to do is create any negative effects because of this film. And so we took their notes very seriously and actually pushed the film to a certain line and didn't cross it so that we're not actually putting them in any legal trouble. And the other thing that we realized as well is that according to Kenyan law, you can't take content in a documentary and use it as evidence in a case. And so if somebody wanted to go after them, they'd actually have to go and get their own evidence.
It's interesting because I also had a lot of hesitation about watching it because I didn't want to suffer watching an elephant get killed. So I thought it was interesting that in the beginning it says this film does not show elephants being killed. And I'm wondering if that was an intentional thing on your part, that none of the elephants that were hunted successfully were shown on camera. Was that intentional?
Yeah, it was very intentional. I mean, in one part, due to what we just said, which is like kind of protecting the characters in a way. But another thing was that the act of killing is not what we were interested in. This. That's something that I felt like a lot of other documentaries had kind of filled that space and used that scene. Like, it wasn't what this was about for us. For me, I was much more interested in the ripple effects around the choices and seeing how that impacts things like identity and family and legacy rather than the actual process and the visual and the grotesqueness of death. So yeah, we were super intentional about that.
I would imagine it would also be difficult when you're around these people that are literally struggling to make ends meet and feed their families, not to want to help them as well.
Yeah, and that was a huge part of the film that was difficult for me. I mean, like, you know, I'm living with these guys, sleeping on their floors, eating the same food, you know, doing everything I can to kind of like mirror the way they're living. And at the same time, coming in as an outsider with this camera, and they know that I could like very quickly fix their financial issues. But one thing I told them up front was that, you know, I cannot be a source of money. I can't give you money for being a part of this. Like, if you want to be a part of this, it has to be because you believe in what we're doing and you want it to exist outside of, you know, outside of me being able to solve your problem. So I didn't, you know, I would never give them money. And that was a really hard thing for them. There were many times they actually quit the project and stepped away and would say things like, you don't care about us. You clearly don't care about us because if you did, you would solve these issues. But and buy us food and pay for these hospital bills and things like that. And at times, you know, they'd quit the project for 2-3 weeks and they're just, you know, waiting for them to come back around, and they always did. But in those first 2 years of production, it was tough. That would happen quite a bit, and it was scary because there were times where I thought the project was over. And then when the film was finished, I went to all of the main characters' wives and asked them, you know, like, what can we give back? Like, what would be of value to you all? And they all told me, you know, it's too late for us, but our children's education is the most important thing for us. So we set up a fund and we're getting all of their kids through college.
In turn, maybe that would prevent them from having to do this foreign occupation to go out there and illegally poach.
I hope so.
On a personal note, because you did go out on these hunts, was that also difficult to sit by and watch?
So hard. It was probably one of the most difficult parts of the project. I mean, I went on 10 hunts total, and the first three, I did not bring a camera because they didn't let me. And there's something that happened, like when you have a camera in a situation like that, it almost provides a separation between you and the event that's happening. And it gives you this heightened sense of purpose because you're saving these moments and these images for other people to see, and that can create change and impact. But once that is stripped from you and you're there, it feels like you're a part of it. Those first three hunts were extremely traumatic. After the third one, I had to step away because I was having a really hard time empathizing with the guys, having a really hard time being around them and not judging what they were doing. And so I stepped away from the project to figure out space, and I had to like kind of dig back in and figure out like what my motivations were for being there and if it was worth it. Because there's this idea that they talk about in the film as well, that like when you kill an elephant, a curse is passed on to you. And that felt very real.
I can't imagine it wouldn't be traumatizing to watch that. I mean, these are very emotional, family-oriented animals. Very intelligent. They're beloved.
Yeah.
If you would like to take people to take something away from this film, even though you're not at all preaching any kind of, you know, you should do this or you should do that, what would it be?
I really want people to come away realizing that the situation is, like, far more complicated than I think we often realize, and that at the core, it's a human issue. I think we look at this as an animal conservation issue, but the solution right now in Kenya is to kill people that are doing this. And what that has led to is a lot of poachers being killed, but also a lot of rangers being killed. And I just don't know that that is the way to solve this. But I think the solutions are going to come locally. I think it's going to be locals who understand the complexities of the culture and the people and have grown up in Kenya and just realize how complicated this gray space is and can see it from the human community perspective. I'm starting to believe that's where the answers lie.
All right. That is John Caspi. He's the director of the critically acclaimed new documentary, When Lions Become Lambs. Eighty-year-old folk singer Judy Collins has finally seen one of her albums reach number one on the Billboard chart. More than 55 years after she first reached ranking, the legendary singer has already had a very successful career with singles on the Billboard charts and many hits. But now she is adding her new holiday album, Winter Stories, to her distinguished record. And it is her first album to reach number one. The light will come again. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Love you, my restless heart at ease. I'll pull the covers up around my shoulders. Feed the fire with my fading tears. Some winter stories foretell a storm. Some winter stories can make. There's a chapter in the end, and a chapter in the first, and what they hear.